Parshas Lech Lecha, Parshas Vayera, deal with Sodom. We have the first part in Parshas Lech Lecha. We're told that when Lot and Avram decide to split up, Lot decides to head for Sodom. Sodom is described as being very rich, very fertile, Kigan Hashem, Keretz Mitzrayim. That was the attraction. That was why people wanted to move there. The downside, of course, was that the people of Sodom are described as being Royim Vachatoim Lashem Ma'ot. They were deeply evil and sinful. They were a paradigm, kind of a nadir of evilness. And that's the foreshadowing, what we're going to read about the week after, the destruction of Sodom in Parshas Vayera. Sodom is held up throughout Tanakh as being an exemplar of what happens when your sinfulness reaches a certain point, and later in Parshas Nitzavim, Hashem warns the Jews that if they sin, they're going to end up like Sodom. Gofris v'melach, Srefa kalartza, lo sizarav, lo satmiach, k'mapecha Sodom v'amoris. Sodom is always held up as being one of the most devastating destruction of biblical proportions to hit any place in the world is Sodom. We aren't really told, though, exactly what is wrong with Sodom. What do they do wrong? We do have a long account in Parshas Vayera, the following week's parasha, where we talk about what they did to the people they thought were guests, the Malachim, who were actually coming as emissaries of God to overturn the city. But we're told that they mistreated them horribly. They formed a riot, a mob to molest them. And indeed, in English, the word sodomy refers to what was going on in that parasha. But it's interesting, as we'll discuss today, in the rabbinic tradition, it's true that's what they tried to do, but in the rabbinic tradition, that is not what we associate with the city of Sodom. That's why in the title, I use the formulation of Sodomian rather than Sodomite to emphasize that the rabbinic notion of Midas Sodom, the conduct of Sodom, the perniciousness, the evil of Sodom, has nothing to do with perversion. They utilize that, but that was more, as we would say today, as a form of political terrorism. It was in service of a more general ideological goal. It was not simply depraved lust. I mean, it was actually more, as we'll discuss, a kind of political terrorism in pursuit of their real goal. What the rabbinic tradition has understood, Talmud, Medrash, and throughout the halakhic literature, which is what we're going to discuss today, is Midas Sodom, based on a pasuk in Yecheskel. It's a fairly obscure pasuk. That's the beginning of the handouts. The pasuk is actually talking about, again, the evils of the Jewish nation, and it's holding up Sodom as a kind of comparison or contrast. But the pasuk, in describing what was wrong with Sodom, it says, "Hine zehaya avon Sodom achosech, behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, gaon sivas lechem, they had pride, they had fullness of bread, v'shalvas hashkate, abundance of idleness, Hayalav Livnoseha, it and its suburbs." There are actually five cities, Sodom Vamora, Admat Zvayim, Tsoar. But Sodom is the famous one. And it says they had plenty of bread, they had peace, they had tranquility, everything was great, everything was copacetic there. The Yad Ani Ve'evyon Lohech Zika. The great sin, what they're held responsible for, is Yad Ani Ve'evyon Lohech Zika. They did not support, they didn't succor the poor people. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. That was the objection to the conduct of Sodom. They refused on principle, as we'll discuss, on ideological grounds. They refused systematically to help the hand of the poor and the needy. As we'll discuss, as we'll see in the Talmud, the riot, the depraved riot, the depraved mob in Parshas Vayera was actually in service of this goal. It was meant to politically terrorize, and it was meant to underscore their refusal to tolerate any guests, any charity, any grace, any kindness, any conduct that showed the milk of human kindness. They wanted to extirpate. They wanted to show this will not be tolerated. We'll rape. We'll riot. We'll do whatever we can. But we want to show this will not stand in our country of Sodom, in our city state of Sodom. This will not stand. The Talmud and Sanhedrin has various accounts, whether they meant literally or just kind of metaphorically, of what was going on in Sodom. And it's true, some of the examples the Talmud gives did actually involve very serious crimes, murder, blasphemy, and the other capital offenses in Judaism. But the theme that runs throughout the Talmudic and Midrashic accounts are not actually the murder and the utter sinfulness of the conduct. The theme is that they had this kind of Ayn Randian opposition to anyone helping anyone else. They were pushing, the Mishnah says, we'll discuss soon, Shali, Shali, V'shalach, Shalach. we made it, we have the money, we have the savas lechem, we have the shalva, hashket, high level of nasea, and we will not share. We will not share. We will not tolerate others sharing. We will not tolerate anybody helping the ani ve'evya. We made it up. We're not helping anybody else up. That was the program of Sodom. And the Gemara gives various, somewhat entertaining, if they weren't so macabre, really, examples of what Sodom used to do. One of them is an account that it says in Sodom they had a bed. And when guests would come, they would visit, they would let them sleep in this bed. If the guests were too tall, they would be literally cut down to size. If the guests would be too short, they would be stretched out like on a rack. Basically, they'd be tortured, mutilated, and killed. Now, about 10, 15 years ago, a sister of mine got married, and I was speaking at one of the nuptial festivities. So I said that it's common that people say Torah, and then they want to speak about the bride and groom, and they somehow stretch the Torah to fit the festivities, whether it's, have to cut the Torah down, whether they have to stretch the Torah, stretch the chasm, stretch the kala. I said I wasn't going to do that. I said I would just say some Torah, talk about the chasm kala, and let them be independent. So I mentioned that we have the Talmudic account of the bed of Sodom, and in Greek mythology, this is known as the bed of Procrustes. Procrustes was some kind of bandit on the way to Athens. He had this kind of bed, and when travelers would come by, he would invite them to sleep in his bed, and then he would either cut them or stretch them. And this, the way the story goes, it was Theseus, one of the Greek heroes, who was invited by Procrustes into his bed. He turned the tables on him, he took Procrustes, he overpowered him, he stuck him into the bed, he chopped him up, and the story has, I suppose, a happy ending. So when I mentioned this, I said you have the Talmudic version, you have the Greek version, and I said I wasn't sure whether the Greek version is a distorted version of the original biblical Talmudic version. I wasn't sure if there were simply two independent stories, or if perhaps the Talmud was simply alluding to referencing a well-known Greek story as just a figurative illustration of how depraved Sodom were. So then I came, my sister actually married someone from here in Greater Washington. So when I came down here for Shabbos, I attended a speech by Rabbi Breidowitz. So he was talking about Sodom. So he said, the Talmud says that Sodom had such a bed, and in Greek mythology, of course, it was the bed of Procrustes, he said. So I found that very serendipitous. I told him, I approached him afterwards, and I said, I also mentioned that this week, and I wasn't sure which one influenced which. Do you have an opinion? And he declined to comment on whether he thought either one influenced the other. But anyway, that is the bed of Sodom and Procrustes. The two stories do end somewhat differently. The Greek version we mentioned earlier, Procrustes, the Theseus overpowers Procrustes and kills him in his own bed, hoist by his own petard. In the story of the Talmud, what happens is Eliezer uses his wits rather than his fists. What Eliezer does is he makes a polite apology to the people of Sodom. He tells them, "I have a neder, a solemn vow. It's my mother's yartzeit." He said, or not yartzeit, he said, but from the day my mother died, I don't sleep in bed. So thank you for your kind offer. So he kind of got out of it without engaging in battle. But so on and so forth. That's just one example in the Talmud about how Sodom, they refused to tolerate hospitality. It was anathema to them. They would torture and maim and kill to show that we do not tolerate hospitality. The Gemara has a horrific story. It goes on. It says there was a girl. Hospitality and charity were against the law, but there was a young woman who wanted nevertheless to smuggle some bread to a poor person. Somehow she was caught. The intelligence services picked her up. So they torture her to death. What do? They took her out onto a roof, or a wall on a roof, and they covered her with honey. They left her for the bees to sting her or bite her to death. Just the most horrific, villainous kind of conduct you can imagine. But again, it was torture and it was murder, but it was in the service of this depraved, selfish ideology. We will not tolerate hospitality, not in our country. There will be no charity. There will be no hospitality. We may be gaon savas lechem, we may have power and might and plenty of food to go around, plenty of resources. It wouldn't harm us to give a few dollars to an ani, but we will not do it. We will not tolerate it being done. The Gemara has another story, and several of these stories indicate that they didn't want to seem that they were egregious monsters. They wanted to have some kind of very thin veneer of civility, so they had these kind of, who would be fooled for how long when they did this, but it sounds like at least on the surface they were pretending that they were normal human beings, not monsters. The Gemara has a similar story that when a pauper would come, they would pretend to all give him charity, so they would all give him money. They would have a secret compact that nobody would actually sell him food. So the ani would go around with a wallet full of money, Nobody would take his payment. Nobody would sell him bread. Eventually, he would die of starvation, and then they would come back, and they would take the money back. So again, it sounds like they wanted to at least make a show of pretending to be decent human beings, not monsters. But in reality, they were monsters. They refused to tolerate charity, hospitality, anything of that sort. And this was the sin. Yad ani ve'evyon lo hechzika. They were programmatically, ideologically opposed to charity, opposed to hospitality, and that is why they were destroyed in an act of epic biblical destruction. This idea is also reflected in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says that there are four midas, there are four types of people. One of them is shali shali v'shalach shalach. He's not a ganav. He doesn't say, I'm taking whatever's yours, I'm stealing it for myself. Shali shali v'shalach shalach. I'm willing to let you have what's yours, but what's mine is mine. I'm not taking anything from you. You're not getting anything from me. That's it. The Mishnah actually brings two opinions on how to characterize such an attitude. The first opinion is Zumida Beinonis. That's normal. That's the typical middle-of-the-road, the mainstream approach. The Yesh Omrim Zumida Stom. Some say this is the culture of Midas Stom. Again, Midas Stom, even though they reached the depths of murder and torture and other things, that wasn't the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem was Shali Shali V'Shalach Shalach. So the Rav explains that even here it seems to be a matter of dispute. Rav Avadya Bar Tanura says it means that sometimes you can't always afford to give the shirt off your back. So sometimes it's legitimate not to give every dollar you have away. That sometimes keeping your own property for yourself is fine. The halacha recognizes private property, certainly. Private property is a fundamental right in halacha. However, someone who goes too far and is always insistent on shali shali, if that's the cornerstone of his whole worldview, if everything is focused and everything he's obsessed with, shali shali, even though it's shali, he's not stealing. But someone who goes too far, that's where you approach the idea of midas tom. At some point, if you just refuse to ever recognize that sometimes, even though it's mine, I really should be letting someone else use it, I really should be letting someone else benefit from my property, at some point you cross the line from being simple mida beinonis, you become mida stom, and you're on your way to the egregious character trait that sealed the destruction, that caused the destruction of Sodom. Now, these are basically agadic passages. These are descriptions, hashkafically, of how Chazal viewed the worldview of Sodom, very poorly, obviously. But the truth is that Midas Tom is actually, in halachic literature, in Choshen Mishpat, in Jewish civil law, Midas Tom is actually a term of art. Often appears in the phrase, Kofen al Midas Tom, which means we compel individuals not to behave in a manner of Midas Tom. Midas Tom is a halachic category. There is a fair amount of halachic literature on the topic. The problem is that the literature is somewhat inconsistent and somewhat scattered, somewhat vague. It's difficult to draw absolutely clear conclusions. For the remainder of our talk, I want to go through some of the classic halachic discussions of Midas Tom, different applications of the principle of Midas Tom and Kofen al Midas Tom, try to understand what the halachic opposition to Midas Tom is, how far does it go, to what extent will we allow a person to indulge his shali shali, it's mine, and don't mess with me, and to what extent will we say, not acceptable, Judaism requires you to share, and that's actually enforceable by a Beis Din. So as I said, in halacha, and in the Talmud, and in the later codes, the Shulchan Aruch, we do have the expression, kofen al midas tom. Literally, we compel people not to engage in midas tom. But the parameters of that, as we said, are up for debate. So my father recently showed me this very interesting interview with one of my great heroes. This is in Ami magazine. There was an interview with Professor Nachum Rockover. Nachum Rockover is an Israeli academic, sort of academic. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham. The Haredi-looking fellow is the interviewer, Yitzhak Frankfurter. The academic-looking fellow is Nachum Rockover. Nachum Rockover is one of the greatest experts on Choshen Mishpat, the greatest, best writers and greatest experts on Choshen Mishpat alive today. He is one of the founders, one of the prime movers behind the Mishpat HaIvri movement in Eretz Yisrael. Mishpat HaIvri is a movement over the last few decades to kind of revitalize, reconceptualize Choshen Mishpat, Jewish civil law, from a modern legal perspective. And there are all kinds of people who are involved in this. There are academics, there are Talmidei Chachamim, there are Rabbanim. And the kind of work they do, the quality of the work, the ideological orientation varies. Some of them are very academically oriented. They're focused on a specific period in Jewish history and kind of ignoring the fact that halacha is a living tradition with layers upon layers, generations upon generations of development. Some of them, like Rockover, is one of the best. Rockover is a tremendous Talmud Chacham, goes by professor, although one of the factoids I think the interview does not mention, if you look at his Wikipedia page, He has, I think, 8 kids, of which, you know, all of them, the boys and the girls, all the boys are either Rabbanim or Mechanchim and Yeshivas or Dayanim, and all the girls are married to the above, basically. Some of them might be active in their own right. Tremendous Talmud Chacham, and what they do, what he does, is he tries to rewrite, kind of reorganize thousands of years of Choshen Mishpat, of our civil law, kind of just reframe it from a modern legal perspective, some elements of comparative law, just organize it and arrange it in such a way to make it, A, more accessible to the modern legal mind, to focus it on modern situations, and in general, to organize it and make it more accessible and more usable by modern dayanim, modern scholars. He actually, they have here in the interview, he had a discussion with Rav Eliashiv, Zichrono Livracha, way back when he was initiating, you know, part of his project. So he spoke to a young Haredi fellow who he saw was uncomfortable with the idea, and the Haredi fellow told him that, I hear there's some opposition, Rav Eliashiv, he's not sure this is such a kosher idea. Anything that smacks too much of academia, too much of comparative law. So Rockover says he spoke to Rav Eliashiv personally. He asked him, can we do this? Did you approve? Can we get your endorsement? Rav Eliashiv was very enthusiastic. He was like, great. He says, currently, Dayanim are a little bit too haphazard. They know what they know. They don't know what they don't know. I think it was maybe Harry Ostrin Wolfson who told, is it Nor Tversky maybe, or Aaron Lichtenstein, who told him, scholarship is not what you know about an issue. Scholarship is what there is to know about the issue. So that's basically the point Rav Eliashiv was making, that to have an organized, systematic treatment of Choshen Mishpat would be wonderful. Shulchan Aruch is excellent, and the Sfarim are excellent, but, you know, the systematic organization isn't always the strongest point of the halachic corpus. And Rav Eliashiv was conceding that arranging something using a modern method and modern conceptual organization could benefit the dayanim, could benefit people who need access to this literature. So Rockover says, he asked Rav Eliashiv, will you join us? So Rav Eliashiv demurred. He said, look, you know, you do what you do, I'll do what I'll do, we will work in our separate spheres. But he, at least according to Rockover, he did agree, he endorsed the basic project. So in the course of this interview, I have a brief excerpt from it in the handouts. In the course of this interview, at one point, Rabbi Frankfurter asked him, what do you view as the defining element of Jewish law? So Rockover is as good as anyone to answer this question. So he says it has to do with tzedek and yosher, the intertwining of justice and uprightness. Then he goes on, what's an example? An example, he says, is the rule that we're discussing of kofen al midas dom. We force someone to behave ethically. Halacha does not allow a person to behave in a selfish way. And Rockover claims, sweepingly, non-Jewish legal systems don't have these concepts. So Rabbi Frankfurter said they do have the concept of equity. So Rockover explains, equity in the Commonwealth, the English common law systems, equity is an external remedy. If the law doesn't yield a just result, so there's a separate system, a corrective system called equity, whose job it is to correct the unjust holding of statutory law. That's equity, but it's a separate thing. It's an alien thing, mibachutz, and it's not the law itself. And Halacha, Rockover explains, rather than having to be corrected by an outside source, fairness is woven into the very fabric of Jewish law. And he goes on, and Frankfurter asks him again, is the combination of din and rachamim a Jewish innovation? So that brings us into the whole topic of l'fim ashur sadin, which is a related but separate topic. Maybe we'll discuss that on a different occasion. But Rockover says, the mixture of tzedek and mishpat, the fusion of din and rachamim, that's what characterizes the Jewish legal system. Rabbi Frankfurter says, again, doesn't that exist in non-Jewish legal systems? Rockover says, no, certainly not to the same extent. And he gives an example, and that's what I have in these notes. Rockover brings a case in Netanya. Somebody bought a very large refrigerator. He couldn't get it into his house, into his apartment, some kind of condominium or apartment like we have. Couldn't get it in. Wouldn't fit through the front door of the building, apparently, and he didn't have outside access via a porch. He had a neighbor who did have a porch, which would have been suitable for bringing in the refrigerator. It could have gone through the neighbor's property, I guess, into the hallway and then into the apartment door. That would have required access to the neighbor's property. So they asked the neighbor. The neighbor said, you can do that, but you're going to pay for it. Doesn't say how much he asked for, but he said, I'm willing to do it, but I'm not doing you a favor for free. You want access to my property, you will pay me for it. The case went to Beis Din. Beis Din says, you may not charge. Basically, Beis Din said, kofen al midas dom. You have no reasonable objection to doing him this favor. And we'll discuss soon whether that's correct or not, but let's, for the moment, assume, take as given, that there is no reasonable objection the neighbor had. therefore you may not charge. That would be midas tom. That would be shali shali. That's what you're saying. You're saying shali shali, and you're not going to step into my property unless you pay me. But you have no reason to be such a stickler about it. That's midas tom, and we, the Beis Din, will not allow you to do that. So Rockover says he told this to an American attorney. The American laughed and said, why on earth would you do that? He said, it's his prerogative, his property. A man's home is his castle. If I were the neighbor with a porch, I would say, my apartment belongs solely to me. You absolutely cannot invade my privacy. That is the view of the majority of legal systems. I am not a lawyer. I cannot comment on whether that is correct or not, whether that is or is not the view of the majority of legal systems. What we will discuss, though, the point I do want to make is that it is far from clear that that is actually the view of the halachic system. That there are certainly opinions that say what this Beis Din said, but it is far from clear that that is actually the halacha. Another case I have in Hebrew, this one, I found this in my notes from a half-written piece from a few years ago, so I don't have either a proper citation or a link to it online. Page seems to have disappeared. But a rabbi in Israel, Rabbi Aviad Stolman, was asked about someone commuted into the city, and parking's pretty tight, as it often is in cities. Now, there was a residential building near his work site, which people were commuting in the opposite direction. People were leaving the residence and going to wherever they worked. So there were parking spaces in this building's residential parking lot that were empty during the day. And he was pretty sure that if he parked his car there, he'd be in and out. He'd be in after the commuters had already left. He'd be back before they returned. He would not be taking anybody's space. He would not be harming anybody. Again, we'll discuss practically whether this is true, but we'll stipulate again, the premise of the question was, I am in no way infringing on the convenience of the building residents. I'm not harming them. I'm not inconveniencing them. I'm simply using a parking space that would be unutilized and empty anyway. May I do that without permission, without asking permission, even if they've said no, may I do that without permission? And Rabbi Stolman comes to the opposite conclusion as this Beis Din. He comes out, again, he brings opinions both ways, but his conclusion is basically no, you may not. That a person has rights to his own property, even if he cannot come up with any tangible reason for denying you the right, it's his property. If he won't agree, maybe it's not nice for him to act like that, maybe not, but in any event, Beis Din cannot force him to give it to you. You cannot take it without his permission. The rule of Kofen al Midas Tom does not give you the right to infringe on his property without permission. Now, in both these cases, the technical details, the practicalities, are difficult to nail down. In these cases, as well as most cases we're going to discuss, it's pretty easy to conceive of how there could be some actual, legitimate reason why the guy doesn't like it. In the parking spaces, I don't need extra traffic. I don't need people coming in and out. I don't need, I like it when it's quiet. What if I want to come back early one day? You can think of a lot of reasons, normal reasons, why a normal, decent person wouldn't want you doing this. In the case of the refrigerator, some people feel they have to clean for 3 hours before they let a stranger into their house. Some of the I don't want to see my house. I'm afraid they'll knock the refrigerator into my knickknacks. I'm afraid they'll scuff the floors. I won't have privacy for 2 hours while the workmen are going through. I won't feel comfortable. I'll have to dress up. So you can think of a lot of reasons why people might not be comfortable with strangers tramping through their house. So in almost every case we're going to discuss, it's very easy to come up with concrete, legitimate reasons. And again, I'm not really out to debate that. The threshold for something not to be midas tom at all is pretty low. As long as you come up with any serious, meaningful reason that most people would accept, that's fine. So our discussion is largely theoretic and largely limited to cases where it will be conceded by all sides that there's no legitimate reason to object. Someone gave me an example that you're sitting on the train, you're reading the newspaper, somebody wants across the aisle to just look at the back of the paper while you're holding it up. It doesn't inconvenience you in any way. There's nothing private in the newspaper. You'll turn the pages wherever you want. Maybe that's a case. But in any event, for the purpose of this discussion, we'll kind of take the facts as stipulated that there is no meaningful inconvenience, and try to understand what the halakhic view of these cases are. As we've seen in modern Rabbanim, we have opinions both ways. We'll see more modern opinions both ways. We'll discuss a little bit later the very common modern question of using somebody's internet connection without piggybacking off a internet connection, or using somebody's Netflix, HBO credentials, stuff like that. We'll discuss those examples too a little bit. But in general, these are kind of the two opinions you'll find in the postgame. Some of them say, like Rakover says, like the Basin says, Midas Dom is a Sifrin Shulchan Aruch. It's part and parcel of Jewish law. You cannot exercise property rights for no reason simply because they're yours, even if your goal is just to charge money for it. While others, Reis Dalman and others, say that you can, that you do have the right to do that. We cannot force you to give in like that. And the truth is, the basic machlokas, we mentioned, you know, the concept of Midas Dom does appear in the Talmud in various contexts, but the Talmudic sources are very, very unclear, very unsettled, and it's difficult to draw any absolutely clear Talmudic conclusion from the passages in the Talmud themselves. One discussion is, which doesn't actually mention explicitly Midas Dom, Talmud talks about a case of two neighbors. One has a tree whose branches or roots or branches are extending into the neighbor's property. Does the neighbor have the right, even at his own expense, to chop down the branches or the roots? So the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch, there are numerous details, but the simple principle that lies behind all the different detailed rulings is that it depends. Does he have any legitimate reason? Is it shading his vegetables or crops? Is it interfering with his plowing? Is it interfering with his basements or construction? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then he has the right to cut out, chop out whatever parts of the root system or branches are interfering. If not, though, he leaves them there. In spite of the fact that they're on his property, the roots are within his side of the property, it seems pretty clear from the entire halacha that he may not cut them down simply because they're in his property unless he can come up with some kind of constructive reason for doing so. That seems to be an example of the principle of Midas Dom. Don't mess with my roots. If they're not bothering you, why would you do that? Not a decisive proof, but that's one example where there seems to be an attitude of don't unless you have a good reason. Some of the discussion revolves around a ruling of a Rambam. The Rambam is based on a Talmudic passage in Bava Basra, but the Talmud is not very clear on this point. We'll just discuss the Rambam and the Tur disconnected from the Talmudic context. The context involves erecting ladders. You want to put up a ladder to reach your gutter, your roof, to climb to your roof, to do some work on your roof. And we're talking about a scenario where your structure is near the neighbor's property, it's near the property line, and the most convenient, the most effective, the only effective way, perhaps, of putting up this ladder is by basing the ladder across the property line on your neighbor's property. It won't be there for a long time. You're going to put it up for half an hour. You're going to climb up, do the work, climb back down. Your neighbor's not on the property right now. He has a big lawn. You're not going close to his house. You're not infringing on his privacy. Anything you can see from the ladder, you can see from your part of the property, too. You know, 2 feet over makes no difference. The height will be on your roof anyway. You'll be in your own house. He has no windows facing you. There's no issue whatsoever. He has no reason to care. You're not gonna uproot his vegetables. It's just weeds over there. Whatever the case is, there's nothing wrong. He has no reasonable objection. The ladder is, it's a very short-term thing. It's not going to stay more than a half hour. You're not going to get any chazakas or anything. There's no reason to object except for the basic naked fact that it's my property and I want to object. Does the neighbor have the right to object to such use of the property? So the Rambam says no. The Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch rules this way, and the major commentators in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, the major commentators are silent. They seem to accept this. So we have the Ramah, we have the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, the silence and apparent affirmation of the major Nosei Kelim that you may put up the ladder. If he has no reason to object, he therefore has no right to object. And the Magen Mishnah explains that the reason is because Kofen al Midas Dom. If he has no reasonable objection, he may not object just because it's his. And that is the opinion of these poskim. The Tur disagrees. The Tur, when he brings this around, he says, I don't understand. He says, like the lawyer in the Rockover's case, I don't understand. It's his property, he says. What right do you have to force somebody to allow you to trespass on his property? It's not your property. It's his property. Get his permission or don't do it. The Tur takes it as axiomatic that a person has the right to exercise rights over his property to prevent people from trespassing, even if he has no reason to, even if he has no legitimate reason, no reasonable objection. That's his right. It's a fundamental right. It's my property, and get lost. We find similar discussions elsewhere in the laws of neighbors where you want to do other things that will infringe slightly on someone else's property. Again, the Rambam, other Rishonim say, why not? As long as there's no meaningful reason, he would have to object. So why can he object? Why should he object? Why can't he object? The Torah again says, no, it's his property. That is, in and of itself, a self-justifying reason. No further reasons are necessary. It's his property. You cannot force him to do what he doesn't want to do. There's an interesting tshuva of the Marshag, Shimon Greenfeld, the leading Hungarian posik in the 20th century. He talks about a case of, there were two merchants. They were both trying to ship merchandise from place to place. They were doing this by common carrier, train, but instead of simply paying per weight, per volume, like our shipping typically is, they were actually renting out entire train cars. A merchant would pay the train and he would, a fixed fee, and he would get the use of an entire car, whatever you could fit in, a flat rate box, so to speak. Whatever you can fit into the train car is included in your fee. So one merchant had about half a train car full of merchandise, so they weren't selling them by half boxes, apparently. So he rented the train car and he filled it up halfway. Subsequently, he found a fellow merchant who had another half train car worth of merchandise. So he said, okay, if you want to use my train, then pay me for it. The other merchant says, why would I want to pay you? Kofin al-mi dastom. You didn't do it for me. It's a sunk cost. You already spent the money. Your half train car is riding empty. So why do you have the right to charge me? You have empty space. You're not using it. There's no loss to you whatsoever. I'm not going to delay you. I'm not going to, you're not going to cost you a penny more. So why would you charge me for it? Kofin al-mi dastom. So the Marshag ruled in favor of the initial merchant, the one who had paid for it. He says he does have the right to charge. The argument he makes, though, is a very incisive and very, very creative one. He says there's such a notion in the Torah of, in halacha, of shutfus, partnership. If two people need something, two people have a joint goal, they enter into partnership to get it done. Whatever agreement they make, however they split the cost, typically the costs will be split unless one side is providing more expertise, more know-how, more work. In general, they split the costs. Now, halacha also has a notion of involuntary partnership. If two people need something, so one of them is not allowed to wait for the other one to do it and then freeload off him. For example, the city needs a gate. There are marauders, there are animals, there are bandits who are invading the city, and any reasonable person would agree the city needs watchmen, the city needs a gate. So the Gemara in Bava Basra makes it very clear that all people in the city must jointly contribute to the necessary cost. That sugya in Bava Basra, that is actually the root sugya, the core sugya at the notion of the halakhic notion of self-government. There's a tremendous amount of literature in the medieval period about local self-government, which is largely rooted in that discussion, the rights of majorities and minorities and representatives and voting. Fascinating sugyas, discussed on other occasions. But in any event, the Gemara clearly says, the Mishnah clearly says, you're not allowed to simply, if you have better nerves, you're not allowed to wait to the other guy who's more proactive, you're not allowed to wait for him to do it and then say, okay, you did it, and you have to do it for yourself anyway. Kofin al-mi dastom, I'm not going to pay you. You did it, and you didn't do anything else for me. I'm going to freeload. You're not allowed to do that. Since both people needed this project done, either one of them can be forced by the other to pay for it. And even after the fact, the Marshag explains, even in his case, when he rented the car, when he rented the train, he didn't know about the other merchant. He had no idea that he existed. Doesn't matter, he says, because it's true that if he really had no notion of the other guy, didn't do it with any notion of shutfus, did it solely for himself without envisioning, without imagining there'd be any other person to join him, then yes, then it would be true that it would be an expenditure that he made solely on his own behalf, and it would be midas dom for him not to let the other guy use it. But in this case, he says, the merchants commonly know that they can find other merchants who they can team up with, even though he didn't have this specific guy in mind. When he rented the car, he certainly had hopes, he anticipated that he could find somebody to share the cost. So now that he actually found the guy to share the costs, that shutfus, it's reasonable that he should have to bear his fair share of the costs. And therefore, in his case, he does allow the guy to charge, even though it might seem to me the stone, because why should you care? Once you have the car, you paid for it anyway. What do you have to lose? Nevertheless, he says, no. Here, the principle of shutfus operates, that it was done in some general sense for both of us, for the both of us in the general sense, and therefore, it's only fair that I should have to pay my fair share too. This was a very common situation we used to have in yeshiva, where people would travel for weekends home. So some of the more commonly traveled routes would be, there'd be tons of people, it could be hundreds of people who'd be going on a given Shabbos. So guys would often rent cars. They would pay $50 or whatever it was for a rented car. Then they would post notices. You know, they had a notice board for hitchhiking, basically for ride sharing, for people to share a ride. And if you're going to one of the more popular places, you would quite likely you'd find several people to join you. And it was the common custom for all the passengers to chip in toward some of the cost, either of the driving, the tolls, the gas, and the cost of the rental car itself. So the question always used to come up, at least as an academic exercise, is this a question of midas dom? I already rented the car. Now you want to join. I have nothing to lose. I have the car anyway. You know, the extra gas is minimal. So is this a question of midas dom? Is it wrong of me to charge, since for me it's a sunk cost anyway? So first of all, as we mentioned earlier, when you get down to the practical details, there's always going to be some inconvenience. Everyone would rather have some people actually would rather have a guest to talk to keep them awake, to just chat with. But for many people, certainly, you'd rather have the car to yourself. You'd play whatever radio you want, you know, just do your own thing and then not have somebody sitting next to you. You have to wait for him to come. You have to drop him off. Even if you make up that you're only making one stop, you have to coordinate. There are certainly a lot of little things why you can argue that it actually is a minor inconvenience. Actually, on our route, you actually save money because of Easy Pass carpool discount. So you can argue the case both ways, but certainly there are cases where it is an inconvenience. But again, let's even stipulate that we're dealing with a situation where there is no downside whatsoever. Like we said, some of the benefits might outweigh the downside. I'll clearly admit that it's better for me to have a passenger. Maybe he'll share part of the driving even. He'll help keep me awake. I'll talk to him. He's a good conversationalist. Whatever it is, let's say we agree that there is no downside to having the passenger. So is this a question of midas dom? So first of all, we have the marshag svara, that even if I don't know you, when I first rent the car, I don't know for sure I'll have anybody. I certainly don't know who it'll be. But certainly, if it's a common situation that you do take passengers, you can argue that your initial rental of the vehicle is with the general intention that you're going to try to find some kind of partner. And certainly, according to the Marshag, that would not be midas dom. That would not be midas dom. And in general, you can argue whether even without the Marshag, if I'm simply doing it to recoup my cost, whether that would be midas dom or not. On the one hand, you can argue it's a sunk cost. The cost is already gone, so it's midas dom to extract money. On the other hand, intuitively, it seems fair that if we basically what the Marshag is saying, if we both need this thing, even if I didn't have any idea you were going to come, it somehow makes a lot of sense, you know, intuitively, that you should pay your fair share. So I'm not sure. The late Rabbi Dr. Yitzchak Levin, in his one of his classic books on Jewish business ethics, as I recall, I haven't seen this in a while, but as I recall, he takes a very hard line that it is midas dom. He says you shouldn't charge a passenger money. The passenger shouldn't offer to pay money because by doing so, he'd be endorsing an anti-Torah value. We should recognize that we're not from stone, that we don't say shalish, shaliva, shalach, shalach. As I said, based on the Marshag and other considerations, I'm not convinced that the matter is quite so simple, but it actually is an interesting thought experiment, both intuitively as well as according to halachic principles. Is it right or is it not right to charge people for a ride, particularly if you have specific costs associated? Intuitively, I think it's different if you have a car that's yours anyway, that you're not renting the car specifically for the occasion. For no significant gas costs, I think intuitively it feels different than if you had $50, $75 in cost specifically for the trip. But halakhically also, it's not entirely clear whether there's a midas dom issue in asking for compensation, accepting compensation for the trip. As I mentioned earlier, one of the very common questions, an inherently modern question, concerns borrowing, quote unquote, borrowing someone's internet connection, borrowing someone's access connections for online services of various sorts. For some people, the famous ones that make the papers are Netflix, HBO. Me personally, the dilemma is my wife is a graduate of Cardozo. As an alumna, she gets library privileges, including access to some of their online resources. Some of their Torah resources are included, the Otzar HaChachma database, the Bar Ilan database. Some of these are quite useful to me. She actually has very limited use for these things, and she'll be glad to give me her access credentials. So the question is, what am I doing exactly by using these services? But first, discussing the internet connection. Someone leaves his wireless network unsecured. You want to go ahead and piggyback off his connection, either without asking him or even against his explicit permission. Are you allowed to do that or not? So contemporary poskim discusses from all kinds of angles. They say all kinds of things, many of which I find less than persuasive. For example, I copied a long piece from one online discussion of this topic. And his opening paragraph is, right under answer is, if nothing is said by the neighbor, it is certainly permitted to use his wireless connection. Anyone who has an unsecured wireless connection knows that the neighbors or passersby will be able to utilize it. leaving the connection unsecured implies a tacit grant permission for doing so. Obviously, that is debatable. People who leave their front door open do not have a tacit understanding. People will come in and crash on their couch, and so on and so forth. So certainly, you know, this could be different. I'm not saying it's exactly like that case, but certainly people may leave it open because they're not so technically savvy. They may leave it open because, you know, there's too much hassle and too much incompatibility between their different devices. So I think the facts can be debated whether we really have a clear sense that he doesn't mind. But the key argument in light of what we've been discussing today is the question of midas dom. Now again, the facts are in dispute. I've spoken to rabbinic colleagues. I've tried asking people who are engineering and internet network engineers and stuff. Difficult to know in general whether there is or is not actual loss or inconvenience to the subscriber. Now obviously, if you're downloading a tremendous amount of data, you're likely to cause congestion. But let's assume again that you're just checking an email or two, very light usage. Now again, in the old days and even today on cellular connections, some people are paying for metered access. Some people pay by the byte or the megabyte. Obviously then you're causing his bill to go up. That's clearly a problem. But let's assume that we're dealing with the more common situation, certainly for residential users, for non-cellular residential users, that there is no increased cost for the subscriber and there is no congestion, no inconvenience. Now also, of course, it should go without saying, if you're doing something illegal that is likely to cause the FBI to come knocking on the subscriber's door, that is also a reason perhaps you shouldn't be doing that, A, because it's against the law, B, you shouldn't be doing it because you are certainly inconveniencing the subscriber. But again, it's nothing illegal, you're checking an email, it's very, very low data usage, there are no costs, there's no inconvenience. So are you allowed to do this? So obviously this can be addressed from the perspective of the law. If the law prohibits the law itself, my understanding is it's not entirely clear, depends on the jurisdiction, unauthorized use of a computer system, what felony, misdemeanor, whatever it is. But putting aside the questions of what the law would say, from a native halakhic perspective, would this be allowed under, so again, the key question is midas dom. If we stipulate that there is no reason for him to object, and no inconvenience, and no cost, and no downside, then one could argue that it's midas dom for him to object. On the other hand, one could argue, as we've seen, there are some opinions, the Torah and others, who say that no, that a person's property is his own. A person cannot be forced to grant somebody else use of his property just because there's no downside. Some poskim say that a person has a fundamental property right. Whatever midas dom means, it doesn't mean that Basin has the right or that you, as the would-be piggybacker, have the unilateral right to just demand that he give you or to take without asking permission to use his connection. So on balance, again, it's a difficult question to answer halakhically. Some people have also reminded me that besides what you're doing for the consumer, you have to deal with whether you're infringing somehow the carrier itself, whether you're infringing on their terms of service. If they don't grant you the right, if they only grant the subscriber the right to use it for his household, that becomes a terms of service issue, and they're probably going to be non-Jews, and they're probably therefore going to be more subject to secular law than halakha. But focusing on the direct and immediate question of the subscriber, so if the facts are, as we said, that there's no downside, then when we're basically dealing with another version of this midas dom question, this is a similar thing to some of these questions about piggybacking on HBO and Netflix and these services. So on the one hand, again, here we have to again consider it both. The more commonly considered question is, are you infringing on the company, on HBO itself? We could consider the question from the perspective of the subscriber. If you happen to borrow his password without asking him, and he if he grants you permission, then the only issue obviously is vis-a-vis the company, which is a different issue. But if we're dealing with you're using your friend's connection without bothering to ask him, just by you happen to know his password, that would be this kind of question. If he's not getting any increase in bill and there's no inconvenience to him, that would again be a question of kofen al midas dom. Some poskim would say that we are kofa. Some poskim would say that we're not kofa. Some poskim have additional arguments, including the fact that it's different than physical trespass. Physical trespass, I'm actually walking on your property. Here, even if I'm using your service, I'm not physically coming into direct contact with your device. A debatable argument again, but that's an argument that some poskim have tried to make. Additionally, with regard to the engineering, the other question is, you have to ask an electrical engineer, if you're running more data through his equipment, are you actually causing more current to drive? Are you going to increase his electric bill? My impression is not to a negligible amount, not beyond a negligible amount, but I'm not an electrical engineer, so I can't really answer that question one way or another.